You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. I'm frightened, Josh. I'm frightened.
Adam? Adam? Where are you? It's me, Josh.
I'm here in Oz, Annie-Ann. I'm locked up in the witch's castle. And I'm trying to get home to you, Annie-Ann.
I'll give you Annie-Ann's life.
I'm not really sure exploring childhood traumas is really the best way to start the show.
Just find your happy place, Adam.
Well, funny you should say that. We will be finding our happy places later in the show with this week's Film Spotting Top 5, movie locations we wish we could visit, plus our review of director Sam Raimi's latest trip over the rainbow, Oz the Great and Powerful, starring James Franco.
And we'll click our heels three times to kick off our Max Ophuls marathon with 1948's Letter from an Unknown Woman. That and more.
Come back, Auntie M.
Ahead on Film Spotting.
If happy little bluebirds fly beyond the rainbow.
Film Spotting is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website, blog, portfolio, and now online store. Check out their new commerce solution so you can start selling stuff immediately. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to squarespace.com/film and use offer code FILM3.
We're also brought to you by Shutterstock.com. With over 700,000 high-quality video clips, Shutterstock helps you take your creative projects to the next level. For 30% off your new account, go to Shutterstock.com and also use offer code FILM3. That's Shutterstock.com and offer code FILM3.
You're listening to Film Spotting from WBEZ Chicago Public Media. We'll take a trip to the top five movie locations we wish we could visit later in the show.
But first, our review of Oz the Great and Powerful. Don't bother donning your 3D glasses for this, because Adam and I didn't.
Am I dreaming?
You're in Oz. I'm Theodora the Good Witch.
Where's your broom?
You don't know much about witches, do you? The Emerald City.
You are here at last, and the prophecy shall be fulfilled.
This is my sister, Evanora. I'm here to serve you.
The royal treasure of Oz. It belongs to you, but only after you defeat the Wicked Witch.
Just how wicked is she?
Towns were destroyed. Children were orphaned.
Great wizard from Kansas. I've waited for you to come and set things right.
Me?
Did those crows just say we're gonna die?
Sometimes things happen serendipitously here on Film Spotting, and show content overlaps in ways we couldn't have foreseen or simply didn't catch. A little coincidence spotting, as we like to call it. It's actually going to happen for me a bit later as we get into Max Ophuls and the imaginary movie locations we'd like to visit in a more indirect way. But there's a more direct crossover between our review of Oz the Great and Powerful, directed by Sam Raimi, and the results of our poll question. Last week, really for no good reason other than both filmmakers having similar career trajectories, we asked listeners, if only one of these directors could continue making movies, who would you choose? Raimi or Tim Burton? I didn't think anything more of the comparison until the lights went down on my screening of Oz and the intricate opening title started. A sequence comprised of sliding, hand-painted-looking black-and-white frames set to a slightly eerie, playful score that recalled Danny Elfman, a recollection later validated when Elfman's credit appeared. At this point, I wondered if this wasn't, in fact, a Burton movie with Raimi's name on it. By the end of the mostly CGI spectacle about a con man and carnival illusionist played by James Franco who was carried away in a hot air balloon during a tornado and thought to be the one and only wizard who will free the citizens of Oz from the shackles of the Wicked Witch, I was even more suspicious of Burton's potential role. And I don't mean the Burton of Batman and Beetlejuice, but the Burton who gave us Alice in Wonderland, about which, Josh, your predecessor, Maddie, said this. I like watching Johnny Depp. He's a great actor. But where's the emotional heart in any of that? If you don't like watching Johnny Depp doing a weird kind of jig, your film is going to fail. When you strip away all the gewgaws and all the fibberty switches, why should I care about anybody in this film? Like Raimi, recycling and hoping to recapture the spirit of the classic 1939 Wizard of Oz, I will now recycle Maddie's question and throw it back to you, Josh. I may not be able to identify them exactly, but there are lots of gewgaws and fibberty switches on display in Oz the Great and Powerful. Did you find any reason to care, though, about anybody in this film?
Fibberty switches?
Fibberty switches.
I'll
spell it for you later.
Thank you. Well, Maddie is so right about Alice in Wonderland. I mean, that's just one of the many problems of that film. I don't think it's a problem for Oz the Great and Powerful. I think this is a significantly better film than Alice in Wonderland, but I really despise that one. The characters, did I care about them? I thought their vision of Oz was pretty interesting, actually, as played by James Franco, as this guy who's just, he's really a trickster at a traveling circus. He lies through his teeth. He wants to get out of Kansas and is finding any way to do that. Ends up in this hot air balloon, which takes him to Oz. That wasn't quite his plan. But I did think it was interesting to have this scoundrel as your lead character, who has no problem pulling the wool over the eyes of the people of Oz so that he can have power and riches. And of course, because this is a family film, we're going to see his transition to a good man, or at least a slightly better man. You see that coming. It's a little obvious and a little bit moralizing. But yeah, I thought he was interesting. Could there have been a better actor than Franco? I think there probably could have been. I think Raimi was maybe casting out of loyalty from working with him in the Spider-Man films. There's someone who might have made this even more interesting, but Franco does have that Cheshire Cat grin that works really well with this role. And so, yeah, I cared what happened to Oz. I cared enough. Let me put it that way. I cared even more for a minor character, the China girl, mm-hmm. that's in this film. Oz comes across her a little ways in when her village has been destroyed. I like how it's called Chinatown and it's actually made of porcelain, china, glasses, and plates. And she's been broken. Her legs are broken. She's the only one he finds in this town. He repairs her with what he calls magic in a bottle. It's just glue, of course. So there's that tricksterism again. And she's this really amazing creation that I just latched onto and wanted to find out what would happen to her. Thankfully, the filmmakers do carry her through the rest of the film.
But I want to go with you.
What? On a witch hunt? No, you're just a little girl.
I'm not as delicate as I look.
That didn't hurt.
I'm coming with you.
Listen, we have one rule in show business. Never work with kids or animals. I'm already working with this thing. Relax. The answer's no. Oh, no. Don't do that. You're fine.
You're gonna leave me alone.
Look, you're fine.
On a rope. In the middle of nowhere.
All you have to do is take the yellow brick road. You'll get there.
But what this movie really struck me as, and it's tied to the China Girl, is it seemed to capture in its use of special effects, which it primarily is. It's not a character study. That's not its strength. But its use of special effects, it was a real litmus test for these sorts of big blockbuster tentpole movies that are going to rely on effects, because it has some, like the China Girl, that are so good and show the power and potential of effects work. And it has the stuff I just dread, the Alice in Wonderland stuff. And mind you, I didn't even see this, as we mentioned, in 3D. It would have been even worse, I feel, if I had. Mm-hmm. But there are those scenes where the CGI is just splattered, so there are pixels as far as the eye can see, these landscapes that you have no relation to. They're just clearly...
The characters don't even have any relationship to them.
Very good point. The characters are just floating around, literally in some cases, floating around in this meaninglessness. Now, Oz also has other elements, especially that beginning where the effects work is so well done. The black and white opening, mm-hmm. which is in the boxy aspect ratio of the original Wizard of Oz, and the magic that Oz is doing in this traveling circus, you know, is there's some effects work going on there too, but it's so subtle and real and you can sense it and feel it. So it was a real struggle for me watching this film. Ultimately, my affinity for the original and the way this picture nods to it with nice little touches and the effects work that really is special carried me over to liking it.
Yeah, you didn't struggle hard enough. you needed to struggle a little bit more. As if that poor China girl hadn't suffered enough, Josh. You go and put the whole weight of this movie basically on her fragile little shoulders. I'm really surprised, actually, you're giving this movie a pass. I found it, to be blunt about it, thoroughly mediocre in so many ways. We do agree on one thing, and that is the China girl is by far the best aspect of the film. When we meet her, that entire exchange is not only a little bit sad and touching, but she does. You're so right about the effects work. She does feel sturdier. She does not feel like flimsy CGI the same way everything else in this movie to me felt like flimsy, disposable CGI. So we do agree on that. But there are two huge problems for me with this film that can't be glossed over by a cute China girl or a great opening credit sequence. And both are things that I've talked about a lot on the show over the years, but I don't always really get to explain. I'm going to start with the biggest one for me. Structure. A strong narrative. Yes, that word that comes up a lot from me anyway. Stakes. It started with Sam on the show. It was continued by Maddie. They were both actors at Kenyon, so they studied drama. They had Aristotle jammed down their throats. Well, my liberal arts education also gave me a decent dose of humanities and drama courses, so I have studied Aristotle as well, and I'm wired the same way. And I couldn't help but think about, of course, the original film. But I could pick any other great movie. But just for the sake of argument, let's go back to The Wizard of Oz, Josh. You've got, in that 1939 film, Dorothy landing in Oz. Strange land, strange people, she's afraid. What's her objective? To go home. There's something at stake if she doesn't get home. The possibility that she'll never get there, that she's going to be lost in this strange place forever. The movie then raises the stakes a little. What happens to her when she lands? She accidentally kills the Wicked Witch of the East, and her sister, the Wicked Witch of the West, is not happy about it and wants revenge. She's out now to get Dorothy. So now not only may she never return home, but she might get killed if she doesn't get home faster. That just raises it a little bit. The drama builds. Along the way, though, we get even more stakes. The added emotional stakes of Dorothy realizing that she actually loves her aunt and uncle, that she misses everyone back on the farm who she thought was ignoring her, didn't care about her, that she was taking them for granted, and she'll be a different person when she gets home, if she gets home. That is the stuff of great drama. What do we get in Oz the Great and Powerful? A hero whose primary objective, the goal propelling him forward, as best as I can tell it, is to get gold. That would buy him what exactly in Oz? I don't know. And to be the king of a land that isn't his own and that he doesn't really care about. Even though we're told earlier in the film that he really craves recognition for his craft and wants to achieve some kind of greatness. So watching the film, right from the get-go, when he lands in Oz, there's nothing legitimately at stake for our hero, for us as an audience to get invested in. And you mentioned him being a scoundrel. For me, it's not a question of how much do we care about him. It's not the fact that he's kind of an anti-hero. I like that, too. Good drama doesn't require the audience to find the protagonist's objective morally upright. We don't have to find him sympathetic. We just have to believe him. We just have to believe in whatever he thinks he wants or needs and find his success or failure in getting it interesting to watch. That's what caring about a character means. And I just have to say, watching Oz the Great and Powerful, I found nothing interesting about what Oz is after, and I didn't care about a single thing he did in this film.
Well, it's not fair to compare this film to The Wizard of Oz.
I don't think I was doing that.
Saying that
I just wanted to be good basic drama.
Yeah, but you're clicking off every plot point. I mean, you call it stakes. It also sounded like a list of plot points to me.
Stakes.
Oz the Great and Powerful has a lot of plot points as well. It's not a matter of how many things must a character overcome. They're very similar trajectories in terms of the things that a character meets and has to overcome. Mm-mm. I mean, I wouldn't want more difficulties faced by Oz. All those things you mentioned about The Wizard of Oz are plot points. This is an interesting character as well. Dorothy's is fairly simple. She gets there. She wants to get home. I mean, you layered some hurdles she has to get through, but that's pretty much it. For Oz's case, he gets there, and in a way, it's more complicated because he doesn't quite know what he wants yet. He doesn't just want recognition for his craft at the beginning. He clearly says he wants to be a great man. He has this aspiration. Mm-hmm. It's this sort of soulless need for worship that fits perfectly with what is offered to him when he gets to Oz. Now, again,
meaningless
I'm
gold
not going
that does
to,
nothing for
the,
him.
The gold is one scene.
But I mean, that seems to be all he wants, Josh.
No,
he brings it up multiple times in the film. That's the only tangible thing he's going to get in this film is gold.
The gold is a very minor part to this.
It's
what it is the
him
power.
Forward.
It's the power to be in charge of this kingdom and recognized for the magic that he doesn't really have. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. That was interesting to me. But I'm not just giving this movie a pass. I'm talking about the things I liked about it, and I didn't want to work hard to dislike it. I'd rather appreciate what I did like about it. And this character arc of Oz was one of the things.
Hmm.
Is he Dorothy? Is he going to stick in our minds like Dorothy?
It's not what I was after.
No, there's no way. But you based your whole argument comparing it on Dorothy.
I just want him to be a compelling character.
Well,
that's all I'm doing. And I'm trying to explain what I see as stakes, what I see as the basics of good drama. And like I said, I could have picked any film where that's the case.
I guess I'm missing the distinction, though. I mean, I could list all the plot points.
Laid it
that
out
Oz
for you as
goes
best
through.
As I could.
I mean, Oz gets there and he meets a woman and he thinks she's on his side,
right,
and finds out that there's some deception there. I mean, there are many things going on here that raise the stakes. Which woman should he trust? Those are stakes right there. For me, it's not a matter of what's at stake in the drama. It's, is this narrative going forward holding me in the story?
You
and
just,
this, and
you
Oz
just said
did
what
it.
Stakes are
well,
for me.
Oz the Great and Powerful did it. It had those elements for me. So to say whether the stakes are there or not, they were for me. I guess I would put it that way. But to get back to what I did like about it, because it wasn't just the China girl. It wasn't that Oz was an interesting figure. I think the opening credits are fantastic, but I also think the entire opening sequence is fantastic, as I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
The work with the tornado
that.
And the work with showing him at this circus, how they created this whole circus world, was very compelling to me. There's also the element of Oz having to continually create his magic out of deception, and how it's more handiwork, craftsmanship, that wins the day than the magic that the witches he's up against. Especially in this contraption, they show you how in The Wizard of Oz we see his head floating mm-hmm. in the smoke. They show you here how Oz puts that together.
Right.
And I really love that, using smoke and mirrors, really.
Yeah.
Smoke and a camera lens. And I liked how that worked thematically throughout the picture, and that this is going to be a weapon Oz uses. There's the great moment. Here's a moment where it differs from Alice in Wonderland significantly for me, is the Scarecrow attack on the Emerald City. The good guys, let's just say, have compiled this Scarecrow army
mm-hmm.
and they send it at the Emerald City. And I don't want to give it away, but basically there's some trickery involved. So what looks like is going to be another Alice in Wonderland inspired by Lord of the Rings style battle sequence, CGI heavy battle sequence we've seen so many times before. The witches flying baboons come down on this army, and we realize the army isn't really what we thought. This isn't going to be a bunch of CGI splattering all over the screen. Instead, it's something that relies, again, on fog,
mm-hmm.
pulleys, trickery. I like that whole theme to the movie.
Hmm.
That was enjoyable to me, and it played throughout. It worked with his character. There were stakes in that battle scene for me. Let
You're
me
listening
put it
to
way.
Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. We're arguing about the new film from director Sam Raimi, Oz the Great and Powerful. Yeah, you're right. That sequence, and the one where we see him as Oz, where we come to see what we're going to know as Oz, or what we do know as Oz in our collective imagination from the original film, that all plays out in a way that's pretty satisfying. And you're right, that sequence is mercifully short and not as annoying as most of the other CGI sequences in this film.
I didn't appreciate it for its shortness.
Well,
and I didn't appreciate it for its lack of annoyingness.
I did. But you keep talking about plot and complications. The fact is, complications are not stakes, and plot and drama are two completely different things. And for me, the point I was trying to make is that I did not get that sense of drama here. And this movie does try, unfortunately, to give us emotional stakes. This question that you touched on, Josh, of will he prove himself to be this great man that he wants to be? But for me, without the basic trappings of a good narrative to hang it on, it's totally empty. And actually, the more I think about this film, I don't think any character in the movie actually has a convincing narrative, except maybe the China girl. We actually understand what she needs, which is to find a new family, basically. And Finley, played by Zach Braff, the monkey, at least we sort of understand his motivations moving forward in this film. Everybody else, for me, just acts how the plot needs them to act in a given scene. So the stakes for me, the big problem with this film, the lack of drama. But the other problem with this film, and I'd be really curious to hear your reaction to this or see if you had any other problems with any of the acting in this film, because you touched on James Franco a little bit, and for me, I don't really care about his performance. It neither hurt the film for me or helped the film at all. But the other thing that has come up a lot over the years on this show, I like to talk about certain actors or actresses who I find to be just not naturally theatrical. They are what they are. They're very good at what they do. They're usually playing some variation on their natural selves. But please don't ask them to play a quote-unquote character. Don't ask them to appropriate a funny voice or wear a funny outfit or a wig or funny glasses or anything like that. They simply don't have the chops to be believable on screen, burdened with all that artifice. The whipping boy for me usually is, of course, Brad Pitt. He's always been Exhibit A. He's now been replaced by Mila Kunis. Poor, unequipped, completely miscast Mila Kunis. She plays here the witch Theodora.
Isn't he wonderful? Didn't I say he would come?
You dare escort that oaf in here and allow him to climb on the hallowed throne?
And why not? He is the wizard.
The wizard, or so he says. Did it not occur to you that he might be an imposter in league with a wicked witch and sent here to kill us?
Wicked witch, don't be ridiculous.
Oh, I'm not the one who's underestimating her cleverness. Or maybe it's you I'm underestimating. Have you finally joined her side, sister?
I am on no one's side. You know that. I simply want peace. It's all I ever wanted, and the wizard can do that. He's a good man.
Oh, what do you know about goodness? Deep down, you are wicked.
You're not
wicked! That temper really is wasted on you.
She has talent. I've praised her in other films that she's been in. I think she is a good actress, but watching her here, Josh, struggle through delivering her witchy lines with a witchy cackle was seriously painful for me. And it's only magnified when she's having to act opposite someone as good as Rachel Weisz, someone who can put on a cloak and say silly lines with complete conviction because she's a talented actress and she has chops and gravitas and she was trained to do it. You know, that's something that she feels very comfortable doing on a stage and she can bring it to the screen as well. It's actually something that reminds me of John Carter, the film from Andrew Stanton. Taylor Kitsch, I'm not going to dog him. I haven't seen a lot of his work. I'm sure he's a fine actor. But you have him in this really heightened fantasy land with all these weird things being said and words we've never heard before and crazy things going on. And he just can't hold up. He can't measure up to guys like Rufus Sewell and Mark Strong, who have been on a stage wearing tights and uttered lines that really don't make a whole lot of sense with complete conviction. And you buy them the whole time. They can sell it to an audience. Mila Kunis cannot sell a single moment of this film. And yes, you can argue that she's just a supporting player, but she's in a lot of this film, and she really did ruin any enjoyment I might have gotten out of this film, because I was with it actually for the first 15 to 20 minutes, just about to the point he landed in Oz and met Mila Kunis, and I realized that there were no stakes. That's when I totally tuned
this movie out. So she was a problem
for
you the first time you see her.
She really was, okay. But it's only especially magnified when she has a little bit of a transformation. Let's just say it that way.
Yeah. You know, the other problem with Kunis, or at least what she's facing, is that we're comparing her to Margaret Hamilton, right? The original Wicked Witch, and that's just not a fair fight. But I think what's up against
her
is that...
I just want her to be decent.
Well, I think what's up against her really, and I didn't find it to be that horrible or distracting or ruinous of a performance. I wish she had brought more to it. I wish that character had been more forceful. I'll agree with you there. I think part of the problem here goes back to the effects. This is one of those instances where the effects do not work for me in the makeup work. I'm not sure. It's difficult to ascribe what technique is being used where. This may have been makeup. It may have been prosthetics. Whatever they used, it looks very smooth. It has that CGI seamlessness to it, to her face when she makes a transformation. And that did completely take me out of the part. And she doesn't sell it. You're right. She doesn't sell it to overcome that. But it wasn't as distracting to me that I thought it ruined the film at all. She becomes more of a prominent figure, but really more towards the end, and it's not like the whole movie has to rest on her shoulders. But it does point to why I ultimately liked about this movie, and what I found fascinating about it is that it did help me to realize possibly what the distinction might be when it comes to effects in movies like this, because I am hopeful for them that we can see fantasy films like this not just become these CGI debacles. And it's that when things work, like the China Girl and like that contraption for the great and powerful Oz when he becomes Oz, it seems to be because we can sense the craftsmanship behind them a little bit. In other words, they're not so realistic that we have no idea what's going on. There's a line a couple times in this movie about wires not working. Mm-hmm. And the way I'd put it is we seem to appreciate effects work in fantasy films when we can see the wires a little bit. We can see Margaret Hamilton's makeup and feel it on our own skin. We can't hear when Kunis has a similar look.
Yeah.
We can sense the smoke of Oz's contraption. The China Girl, the light falls on her shoulders. It has that richness that light really does. So I'm not just dogging CGI here. It's how it's used. And so Oz had enough of these elements where it made me feel hopeful for fantasy films being able to figure out how to retain some of that tactile nature that gives us a point of connection so that these fantasy films just don't die and we write them off forever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, more connections, I think, for me as a viewer, would have been great with this film. That's Oz the Great and Powerful. It is out now in wide release. If you see it and agree or disagree with our takes, you can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net, or leave us a voicemail, 206-203-2463. You can also find us on Twitter, @filmspotting, and facebook.com/filmspotting.
Adam and I will solve the sequester next in Massacre Theater, then launch our Max Ophuls marathon with Letter from an Unknown Woman. I hear Joan Fontaine has a great cookie.
How dare you?
Stay with us.
Somewhere over the rainbow, way up high, there's a land that I've heard of once in a lullaby. Somewhere over the rainbow, skies are blue, and the dreams that you dare to dream really do come true. Someday I'll wish upon a star and wake up where the clouds are far behind me, where troubles melt like lemon drops way above the chimney tops. That's where you'll find me, somewhere birds fly, birds fly over the rainbow. Why, oh, why can't I?
We're going to interrupt here for a quick minute, folks, just to mention our sponsors once again, including Shutterstock, where you'll find the perfect video for your next creative project. Whether that's for your website, advertisement, or a multimedia presentation, they have clips in a variety of digital formats. Most of these do come in HD. Shutterstock sources video clips from around the world, puts them at your fingertips. Shutterstock adds 10,000 video clips each week, so every time you visit, you're going to find something new.
You can try Shutterstock today by signing up for a free account. You don't need a credit card. Just start an account and begin using Shutterstock to help imagine what your next project could be like. Once you decide to purchase, use offer code FILM3 and new accounts will receive 30% off any package. That's Shutterstock.com, and for 30% off new accounts, use offer code FILM3. We're also brought to you once again by our partners over at Squarespace. Squarespace Commerce provides a powerful and flexible e-commerce solution that's integrated to work with every Squarespace template. It allows you to sell things both physically and digitally. You can sell books, you can sell music CDs or MP3s, ebooks, whatever you want to move. They've got a fast merchant account set up so you can accept payments right away with credit or debit cards. And they have a single interface for order management so you can track them, provide customers with email updates, print shipping labels, and add coupons. All I can say, Josh, is where was Squarespace Commerce when we were trying to move our t-shirts at the end of last year and selling them through our website?
Could have been helpful.
Really could have come in handy. And as we look to launch our store again sometime, hopefully this year, and move a little bit more merch, I think Squarespace Commerce could come in very handy.
For a free trial, just go to squarespace.com/film. You can sign up for your free account. You don't need a credit card. Just try it out and start building your own website. If you do decide to purchase it, use offer code FILM3 to get 10% off your first purchase on new accounts. And this includes monthly and annual plans. Also, don't forget about free domain registrations for annual plan customer subscriptions. That's squarespace.com/film and use offer code FILM3. Squarespace, everything you need to create an exceptional website.
You want to know what's wrong with our waterfront?
It's the love of a lousy buck. It's making love of a buck, the cushy job, more important than the love of man. It's forgetting that every fella down here is your brother in Christ. But remember, Christ is always with you. Christ is in the shape up. He's in the hatch. He's in the unit. He's kneeling right here beside Dugan. And he's staying with all of you. If you do it to the least of mine, you do it to me.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. That, of course, is Carl Malden as Father Barry, one of the all-time great memorable lines in cinema, I'd argue, from On the Waterfront. We'll hear a little bit more about Father Barry as we get to this week's poll question a bit later in this segment. But right now it's time for everybody's favorite part of the show, Massacre Theater.
We perform a scene and you get a chance at winning a prize. Last week we massacred this scene.
They look like big, good, strong hands. Don't they? I always thought that's what they were. Oh, my little friends. The little man with his racing snail. The night hawk. Even the stupid bat. I couldn't hold on to them. The nothing. Pulled them right out of my hands. I failed.
No, you didn't fail. I'm the one who failed. I was the one chosen to stop the nothing. But I lost the Auron. I can't find my luck dragon. So I won't be able to get beyond the boundaries of Fantasia.
I hate it when I lose my luck dragon.
It's a bummer.
That was the voice of Alan Oppenheimer as Rockbiter and Noah Hathaway as Atreyu from 1984's Neverending Story. It was directed by Wolfgang Peterson, written by Peterson along with Hermann Weigel.
I'm going to guess it's Hermann Weigel.
Hermann Weigel? All right.
I don't know.
Go with it.
It's German anyway. We got this from John in Brisbane, Australia, a longtime listener of the show. Directed in 1984, it was Wolfgang Peterson's first English language feature, the tie-in being your review of Stoker last week, which was Park Chan-wook's first English language film as well. So that was our basic tie-in. Of course, John has gone above and beyond like so many of our listeners here, and he writes, further tie-ins can be made the following ways. The Neverending Story has a similar plot device as your film review this week, Oz the Great and Powerful, where the action starts in the real world, and as the film progresses, the characters are transported to a fantasy land. The Neverending Story is based on a novel, as is Oz the Great and Powerful, and the voice of Rockbiter, which Josh portrayed magnificently,
oh, thank you,
is by actor Alan Oppenheimer, who in 1990 voiced the character of the Wizard in the made-for-TV animated series The Wizard of Oz, celebrating the 50th anniversary of the 1939 film.
And John goes on.
Yeah.
Completely unrelated, but totally fascinating, is the actor who plays the character of Atreyu, Noah Hathaway, later went on to star in Troll from 1986, playing the character Harry Potter Jr. Wolfgang Peterson, at one stage, was being considered as a director for Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone.
Yeah.
Wow.
He's the only one of all the entries, and we did get a lot of people recognize that scene, mainly thanks to your performance. He was the only one, though, that pointed that out.
That is
about
some
Harry Potter and Wolfgang Peterson.
That's intern-level work going
yeah.
on right there.
It's better than intern-level work. We also heard from Josh Holtz in New York City, who says, Josh, I knew the movie before you were three lines in. The Neverending Story was a seminal film for me. I know a lot of people in my generation have a version of this, The Dark Crystal, Labyrinth, Time Bandits, some strange 70s or 80s fantasy extravaganza, usually dripping with Muppets. The Neverending Story was mine.
I still go back there in my mind when I think about terrifying suspense, the final confrontation with Gmork. I don't remember it that well.
I've never seen it, so.
With uncontrollable sorrow, the swamp of sadness, and most notably, breaking the fourth wall. Lots of films use this technique, but you never forget your first, and this one blew my mind. I'm pretty sure it's what set me on the path towards creativity and imagination that I'm still on today as an aspiring writer. Josh, your take on The Rockbiter was exquisite. Boy, I don't know what this says, but I've actually had seminal experiences with The Dark Crystal, Time Bandits, and Neverending Story. I guess I gotta go see Labyrinth.
It says we had very different childhoods.
Yeah, sounds like it.
Because I don't think I ever made it through all of Labyrinth. I did see The Dark Crystal, but The Neverending Story, I wasn't kidding, I never saw that film. I remember, I think we even had the VHS, and I want to say maybe one of my sisters was into the movie, but you joke about how fantasy isn't my language.
Yeah,
it's just not, and I was never interested in seeing it.
You know what? My younger sisters were actually into it more than me, so maybe there's something to that. But hey, Anything dripping with Muppets, that sounds great.
Yeah, that's
great.
That's right up your alley, isn't it, Josh?
That.
Well, we have been talking about the fact that we're getting so many good tie-in emails like this. I don't know, at the end of the year, we may need to give out a prize for the best Massacre Theater tie-in email.
That.
So keep up the good work, everybody. We'll find something to give away at the end of the year. If you do want to hear Josh's exquisite, magnificent take on Rockbiter from The NeverEnding Story, plus our review of Stoker and our top five movie Mother Daughters, you can find that show at filmspotting.net or get it via iTunes. Not a record number of entries, as a lot of people predicted.
Huh?
Not a record, but we did get a lot. So, Josh, reach into that brimming film spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
That's Rod Lott from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma.
Congratulations, Rod, who I believe is a film writer for the Gazette down there in Oklahoma City.
Uh-huh.
So great to hear from you, Rod. Congratulations. Email feedback at filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with your six-month subscription to Fandor.com.
The other day, when I heard Mr. Fabian tell Miss Channing that her understudy was going to have a baby, and they'd have to replace her.
And you want to be Margaret's new understudy?
I don't let myself think about it.
We move on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, presented by Fandor.com, a site to discover, explore, and share independent foreign and classic cinema. More information at Fandor.com/filmspotting.
Help support the show by signing up now. Film Spotting listeners get the first 30 days free.
We're not going to give you any hints this time. I don't think we need to. Maybe we'll just give them that it's an older film.
All right, let's stop there, though.
It predates The NeverEnding Story.
Yes.
We're giving you that.
Good.
We're giving you that. I'm going to start this off. I am not ready. I have not been doing my warm-ups, and I have not practiced my lines, so this is going to be, well, of course it's going to be rough.
Familiar territory for
it
you,
is.
So.
Well, that's another hint there. I'm going to start it off, so you're going to give me the action.
All right, and action.
Well, I'm getting out of this town so fast, away from all the words and the monuments and the whole rotten show.
I see. When you get home, what are you going to tell those kids?
Well, I'll tell them the truth. Might as well find it out now as later.
I don't think they'll believe you. You know, they're liable to look up at you with hurt faces and say, what did you do? Quit? Didn't you do something about it?
Well, what do you expect me to do? And scene.
Well, it was short. We made up for last week.
It was short. And the last time I did it was much better. I'm going to go on record and say that. If you know what film we just massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, March 18th. You know what the problem is that the last time I played that actor in a scene, he was a much more tormented character. Here he's too plain.
Yeah.
I need some angst.
You need something more to chew into,
I need
huh?
something to latch onto with my scenes, Josh.
Next time. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next week's show. To get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Sure, I could have stayed in the past. Could have even been king. But in my own way, I am king. Hail to the king, baby.
Hail to the king, indeed. Sam Raimi's go-to guy, Bruce Campbell, there, talking about himself as Ash in Army of Darkness, but he could have been talking about Sam Raimi in response to our poll question from last week, looking at the clear response from our audience. Josh, we asked you, as referenced earlier in the show, if only one of these directors could continue making films, who would you pick? Your options were Tim Burton or Sam Raimi. How did it come out?
A shocker. Tim Burton, 37%, Sam Raimi, 63%. Never would have guessed that.
And I think last week, in fact, not only did we not guess it, we predicted that Tim Burton was going to run away with it, even as I flip-flop and change my mind to Raimi as I was talking about it. It's true, we definitely didn't foresee this, but at the same time, and we're going to get into some of the responses here that will help explain things a little bit, I think, it's probably fair to say that if you're not thinking about the 80s stuff that Burton did and you don't have a real fondness for it, there's a lot of hate out there for, you know, Dark Shadows and Alice in Wonderland, so maybe people were looking more at recent trends.
I think there's a lot of hate, but I don't know if they're taking into account as many of Burton's recent movies. They haven't all been that bad. Dark Shadows has been bad. Alice in Wonderland was dreadful. But even in the last 10 years, I mean, Frankenweenie, Corpse Bride, ton of people like Sweeney Todd. I wasn't as high on it. I thought it was okay. I did like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
You were the one.
I'll go back as a good film. I'll go back to Big Fish. It was a wonderful movie. Okay. I mean, he made all these in the last 10 years. I don't get this at all.
Okay, so our listeners are being short-sighted. Let's get some of the responses. Aaron Martin says, I just don't think I could ever be excited for a Tim Burton movie ever again. Everything he puts out just seems so generic, even with his garish aesthetics. At least Raimi can still pump out unique movies like Drag Me to Hell.
All right, well, Max O'Connell adds, Raimi wins this one pretty easily. I hate to give up on Burton, but with few exceptions, Big Fish, Sweeney Todd, he mentions, I've found his output over the past decade uninspired, unimaginative, and often dispiriting. Both Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and Alice in Wonderland stand out in particular as examples of how Tim Burton has turned from an idiosyncratic personality to a brand, with both trying and failing to recapture the carnival show zaniness of Pee-wee's Big Adventure and Beetlejuice. Raimi has had his share of misfires, but I'd rank the first two Spider-Man movies and Drag Me to Hell among his best work. His joy as a showman, even a grotesque one, still shines through in his films. And even if Oz the Great and Powerful turns out to be a dud, I'm more than willing to give him another shot.
There you go. And I have to agree with Aaron and Max on at least the point about Drag Me to Hell. I think that's a more interesting film than any of the Tim Burton films you mentioned from the last decade.
No way.
Yeah, without
no way.
A doubt.
It's more personal than like Dark Shadows and
yes,
even Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you that.
And that matters.
But Big Fish is intensely personal.
Okay.
I mean, you're writing off some really good work to say that. In the last 10 years, Drag Me to Hell is better than all of Burton's stuff.
The ones you mentioned,
in the last
yes.
10 years.
Yeah, I think it probably
wow.
is. I really did like Frankenweenie, but Big Fish, for whatever reason, was
Corpse
not a
Bride?
Film that wowed me. No, Corpse Bride is not a film that does a whole lot for me,
huh.
Josh. I'm sorry. But we do get to some defenders of Tim Burton, not just you, Josh. Peter says, I'd say I'm as conflicted as Adam was on the show about the question. Burton's recent lows are much lower than Raimi's, but Burton's highs are higher than Raimi. Ed Wood is better than anything that Raimi has done, but Dark Shadows and Alice in Wonderland wallop Spider-Man 3 or The Quick and the Dead.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. That's kind of how I thought about it, too.
Hmm.
Lastly, we heard from Josh Rosenfield in Farmington, Connecticut. I'm shocked and disappointed that Raimi is so thoroughly thrashing Burton in this poll, when Burton is clearly the superior director. Raimi's Spider-Man films are overrated garbage. Well, that's pretty harsh. I don't think I'd go that hard. Not only does every character say exactly what they're thinking in every scene, Josh goes on, but Raimi's direction has the effect of making everything feel fake.
Hmm.
These problems are just as evident in Oz the Great and Powerful.
Yes, they are.
Which also features terrible pacing and staging. Burton's failures are louder and more obvious, but his successes are so much better than the best films that Raimi's made. If Raimi couldn't make another film ever again, nothing of value would be lost. Burton offers a unique cinematic voice, one that would be sorely missed if he was gone. What makes Raimi so special? In my opinion, not much.
Yeah, that really is the question. It gets back to what I said about maybe how they're trending, and we disagree maybe on how they're trending. Listeners clearly disagree about how they're trending, but the question was if only one of these directors could continue making films. So, yes, you can factor in successes like Beetlejuice and Batman if you want, but that's not really the question. Which one's had the better career? Which one has made better films overall? It's right now at this point in time, if you could only see one more of their films, whose would you rather see? I think that maybe does make it more complicated than just saying, well, I think Burton's the better filmmaker.
Yeah, but because he is, I'd go with Burton.
Well, we did have one final comment I want to share because I think this actually nails it. From Neurocinema, let them both continue to make films, but only if they pledge to adhere to some Von Trierian obstructions. Some suggestions, a budget cap of $10 million, no CGI, and no franchises or remakes.
I think
here,
that's
here.
Brilliant.
We can all agree on that. Thank you, Neurocinema, for bringing us together. Let's go from that divisive question to one hopefully a little bit more peaceful. We played Carl Malden as Father Barry coming into this segment from On the Waterfront because we're looking ahead to next week's top five and next week's show. We are planning at this point to discuss the new Christian Mungiu film Beyond the Hills, which is set in a monastery.
Right.
So with that in mind, we're planning to do our top five movie religious figures, which also seems appropriate considering that as we are taping the show, the cardinals at the Vatican have actually assembled for the conclave. And by
yes.
the time you all hear this, it's very possible that the world has a new pope. So we thought it was timely. We're asking you simply, which of these movie priests would have made the best pope? Their options are
Father Barry, Carl Malden from On the Waterfront, Father Marin, played by Max Vincito from The Exorcist, Cardinal Glick, which was memorably George Carlin in Dogma, Father Brian, played by Edward Norton in Keeping the Faith, Father Flanagan, that's Spencer Tracy in Boys Town, the priest of Ambercourt, Claude Ledoux, who we discussed recently in Diary of a Country Priest, and we'll give you the option conscientiously objecting to the poll question.
If you just don't want to participate in this religious mumbo jumbo, you do have that option. Where are you going, Josh? It's tough.
After that preaching that Carl Malden just did, it's hard to resist. I think I'd go with Malden.
Yeah, I did consider George Carlin, even though I'm not a fan of the movie Dogma. I love George Carlin so much, and he's so funny that I just love imagining a world where George Carlin is the Pope. So yes. That is my first instinct. But if I'm really being serious, why I'm being serious about this poll question, I don't know. But I'm probably with you that it would be Carl Malden as Father Barry.
Are we going to release the results by some colored smoke?
Yes, we are.
All right.
When the poll has settled, white smoke will come up from our website. Usually a bad sign, but we'll figure it out somehow. Speaking of our website, that's where you can find more information about Film Spotting's bonus content. This is available to our app subscribers if you have our Android app or our iOS app. And this week, we're going to share a little bit of your feedback on our recent top five unseen characters. And Josh, to give listeners a taste of what that feedback is like, why don't you read this email from a listener, Cheryl Brody.
Is The Usual Suspects in the Pantheon or in the penalty box? I figure that must be the reason that neither of you chose Kaiser Soze as one of your top five unseen characters. This unseen character drives Roger Verbalkind's narrative throughout the entire film. If it is a member of the Film Spotting Pantheon, perhaps you could post a list of Pantheon films so that I do not find myself completely frustrated with your choices during my morning commute.
Oh, you'll still be completely frustrated as you listen. That's not going to solve that. Thank you, Cheryl. That answer, Kaiser Soze, that response was definitely one of the most popular responses to our list. Not the most popular. We'll get to some of those in the bonus content. But to answer Cheryl's question, I know we both feel this way. I didn't really consider Kaiser Soze because it's my assumption that I see Kaiser Soze in that film.
I saw him.
Even though I do understand their arguments to the contrary, I'm saying we saw him, so it didn't work for me, even though I'm a big fan of that film. And we do actually post all the films that are in the Film Spotting Pantheon over at filmspotting.net. If you just click on the top five link, it's right there, Pantheons. You can find it. So, Cheryl, hopefully that will help you not get so frustrated with us. Two other quick notes. If you are looking for more things to read on the internet, Josh, we don't mention it very often, if at all, but you can read your written reviews of most of the movies we talk about and some others at larsononfilm.com. And I have become recently obsessed with Letterboxd.
Yeah, you're hooked, huh?
I am hooked. And some of our listeners have caught on to this, and I have, I don't know, 400 or so followers at this point. Not that I'm bragging or anything, Josh.
That's really impressive,
if you,
Adam.
If you want to follow me on Letterboxd, where I have been ranking some of my favorite directors' work, and I also post a lot of times some early reviews if you want to have my thoughts on a film spoiled for you. I don't go
in
depth.
Yeah, I better not follow you.
You really shouldn't. No, but if you do want to follow me on Letterboxd, that's letterboxd.com, and that's boxed without an E at the end, boxd.com/filmspotting. And I feel like we have to at least acknowledge the fact, because we didn't do it last week, Josh, that March 6th, so just about a week ago, was the 8-year anniversary of Film Spotting. The first episode ever was posted on Sunday, March 6th, 2005. So I don't really have any streamers or balloons or any cake or anything, and we probably don't deserve it, but there it is.
Boy, you know, 8 years goes fast to me. It feels like hardly more than a year.
The truth is, I've had rather an easy time of it. People accepted my music very quickly. Perhaps too quickly. Sometimes it's easier to please others than oneself. What are you going to say? You know you don't talk very much.
Well, I can't say it very well, but...
Yes.
Sometimes I felt when you were playing that...
Go on.
That you haven't quite found... I don't know what it is. What you're looking for.
How long have you been hiding in my piano? Now, never mind explaining. I'll just assume you're a sorceress and that you can make yourself very tiny. It might be a good thing to have a sorceress for a friend. Who knows? You may be able to help me someday.
We're moving on from our Marx Brothers marathon to another subject, the films of German-born, French-residing director Max Ophüls, particularly those he made between 1948 and 1955. We use these marathons to fill in the holes of our cinematic knowledge, and Ophüls was a blank spot for both of us. We're going to start with 1948's Letter from an Unknown Woman, which was the second completed film Ophüls made while he was living in America and working in Hollywood. It stars Joan Fontaine as a teen circa 1900 Vienna, who nurses an unrequited love for a concert pianist played by Louis Jordan throughout her life. Now, I hadn't seen any Ophüls movies before, but I was familiar with a trait that is most associated with him, and it's the use of cranes, dollies, tracking shots, all sorts of techniques to create a fluid and highly active screen style. We certainly do see some of that in Letter from an Unknown Woman, so I think that's as good a place as any to start our conversation. I was particularly interested in doing that because these are the things that bothered you, Adam, about one of our early Marx Brothers films, Animal Crackers, and that it was fairly inert and stage-bound. So I'm wondering if Letter from an Unknown Woman was a particularly refreshing experience for you on this end. Did it satisfy that desire for a more cinematic experience from the movies? Or was this maybe too much directing for you? Did you feel like it was going over the top in style?
Well, I do want to be clear that a camera that moves a lot doesn't automatically equal great cinema for me. Camera that doesn't move at all doesn't necessarily equal bad cinema. But too much, no, I'd say that's impossible here with this film anyway, because the camera may move a lot, but it's so elegant and graceful and subtle that there's no way I could argue that Ophuls overdoes it at any point. The camera glides us through this story in a way that makes you feel a bit like you're floating, which we are through this story because it's through the past. It's essentially one long flashback, and it feels kind of like a memory, a tragic one at times, a happy one at times as well. And I think it does beautifully offset what is otherwise a pretty sad, depressing tale. We get a line at a crucial part in the film that says, "If only," and that's really the hallmark of melodrama. If only, you had been there where you were supposed to be. If only we'd recognize each other or saw each other at the right time, everything could have been different. My favorite part of the film, though, isn't all of those examples where the camera's moving so much. It's where Ophuls is still. And it's a moment that's heightened because the camera moves so much throughout the rest of the movie. And it's not the film's most famous sequence on the train, which we'll get to a little bit later, I'm sure. But with Ophuls, what you see, I think, in this film is that he is not content to just wallop us with a tragic melodrama and let the actors and the dialogue do all the work. He communicates character and story with the camera, and he actually cues the audience into the reality of a situation before the characters themselves are aware of it. So for me, the key moment, my favorite in the movie, is a repeated camera shot. The main character, Lisa, she's a young girl. She's waiting for Stefan to come home one night. She hears him come in with a woman and hides up on the stairs and is looking down on Stefan and the woman that he's brought home. And it's notable because at that point, we've seen a lot of activity happen on that staircase. We've seen people go up and down it, and we've seen it every which way. But we've never seen it from that angle before. So right away, it catches you off guard, and it makes you really focus on what's going on in the scene. But she's also, as we're having an epiphany, she's having one because she's seeing something new. She is realizing that this is the type of cad character he is, and that they're probably never going to be together. And she leaves, and she embarks on a new life. She leaves Vienna altogether. So that sets up my moment, which is later in the film when they finally connected, and she's the one being invited up to his room this time. And the camera starts. They're down at the bottom. The camera starts where she was standing before, up in that elevated position. And it just slowly pans to the right as they walk up the staircase, and they end up in the same spot the other woman stood with him before when she was watching them. So it links her to that woman visually. And we know in that moment that she's as disposable to him as that woman was. There is nothing more romantic or life-changing than that previous encounter for his character. And there are so many symmetrical moments like that in this film. The whole film is actually symmetrical, right? Because it ends back where it began. Another key one is when she says goodbye to her son on the train tracks. And it's the same kind of framing, same moment as when she said goodbye to him. It even covers 2 weeks. He's leaving for 2 weeks, just as he said he was only going to leave her for 2 weeks earlier. And Ophuls, I think, puts too fine a point on that there, Josh, and amps up the melodrama a little bit, draws our attention to it. But that's the rare clunky moment in an otherwise just really beautiful film.
The staircase scene is it. You're absolutely right. That's the one for me as well. And I liked the words you used to describe his style. Glides, elegant, graceful, those are all right. But the other one, subtle, you said.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're absolutely right, is that we often associate this sort of camera work as being show-offy or ostentatious. And the subtlety is at work in that staircase scene, because you described it as primarily a still shot, and it pretty much is. But even that first one where she's spying, we get a sense that things are a little off kilter, whether there's some slight movement, I'm trying to remember now, or a little bit of a jerkier pan, and we feel her dizziness,
yeah,
her realization that, oh, here he's coming home. I was going to maybe have a moment with him, and now here he's home with another woman. And the parallel is just so beautiful later on when she's with him, because of the elegance that is brought to it. There, it's as if the camera is ushering in a royal pair. I mean, there is such a different use of the camera from the exact same vantage point that it's just a gorgeous example of filmmaking. And you're right, this movie does have that throughout. So it was a great introduction for me, really liked it overall. There's one sticking point that's just prevented me from absolutely loving this film, and that's that even though Fontaine is clearly the star and it's her story, I was trying to get past the fact that everything still revolves around the guy. It's all focused around the man. And this is a distinctive problem we still have with Hollywood romances and romantic comedies. And it's interesting because Letter from an Unknown Woman is so admirably modern in a lot of ways, including how it deals with sex. We won't get into exactly because it involves some spoilers, but I liked its frank admission of the part that actual sex comes into play in this story.
Right.
But the treatment of this as being about the man, in other words, this woman's entire identity and pursuit of any sort of life depends on the guy. Now, I know that part of that is going to be what makes it a tragic story, and we need that. And I
do appreciate
that. And
makes it melodramatic.
And makes it melodramatic as well. But was that a stumbling block for you at all?
It was a little bit, but by the end of the film, no, it wasn't. And I've wrestled with this a little bit here as I thought about the film, because it's considered a quote-unquote woman's picture and whatever that means. But I think it goes back to the fact that there is a complex dynamic with her character. I'm with you that at first there was a part of me that was kind of turned off by the fact that she's this doting young girl. And then even when she grows up and she finally has her big night with him, when he sits down to play at the piano, she gets down by the stool and she stares up at him. I mean, almost like a puppy dog looking up at her owner. That's how she looks at him in that scene. She's content to be amazed by him. But the more I thought about it, Josh, I came around to the fact that it is more complex, I think, because she also makes really difficult decisions to take responsibility for her actions, to not burden him or beg him as a man, but to live her life, to deal with what she's done. Even if he was responsible in some ways as well, she said, it's my burden, I'm going to take it, and I'm going to make it work. And in some ways, there's an odd synergy with Oz we talked about earlier, because you've got another character who the woman just wants the man to realize his full potential, his greatness. That element is there. But what really stuck it for me, Josh, what really kept it from being a problem, was at the end of the film, there's a moment where, I'll just say, to not spoil it completely for anybody who hasn't yet seen this movie, and I really hope people listening will check it out if they haven't, there's a moment where her identity is finally fully realized. And the film is called Letter from an Unknown Woman.
Right.
And we finally really know. The audience has always known, but the key character finally becomes aware of her identity. She's no longer an unknown woman. And I think that moment is really powerful because it made me think about how many unknown women there have been just like her, who have been marginalized and abandoned and disposed in the way she ultimately is disposed. So for me, I was able to see that angle in it and find it redemptive in that sense.
That's there, though you could also say that her whole life was there to service this man's moral awakening, which is still a little bit of a problem
for me. And
that's
a valid criticism.
And, and I guess, you know, for me, I was going back and forth while watching it. I could have totally bought in if I felt that the movie was recognizing her pursuit of him, yet always yearning to have her also desire some sort of independence or life of her own.
Yeah.
And instead, I felt like the movie wanted us to yearn for them to get together.
Yeah.
And that's where I got caught up.
But that is maybe
it's
on
part
some
and
level,
parcel.
Yeah,
of
you have
the,
to go with the melodrama.
Of the melodrama.
I think,
I
though,
see that.
I would also say that you have to look at the decision she makes at the end of the film as being a key one, in the sense that if she was truly a powerless woman, if she was truly a woman who only cared about being loved by this man, she could have made a decision in those final moments to essentially beg him and to actually force it. She could have forced it out of him. And she says no. She says this should have happened the quote-unquote right way. I shouldn't have been put in this position. And she walks away in that moment. That's a bold, powerful move.
So I take it Fontaine worked pretty
she
well
works
for
like
you.
Gangbusters for
yeah?
me.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And Louis Jourdan, too. I think they're fantastic.
He is pretty amazing in a role that, I mean, he is the cad, as you said. Mm-hmm. He's despicable in a lot of ways, yet he also does allow us to feel that sense of the appeal that he has for her. You pointed to that scene about the piano, and I think that's interesting because I almost wonder if Ophuls is playing with something here that tries to counter the problem I had with it, in that she also seems to be drawn to his music in a lot of ways,
without a doubt,
as much as him. And I like that idea. I like how that's a recurring theme in the film. If you notice, in the courtyard, she first off recognizes he's arrived because of his music, not because she sees him.
She's
she hears
in love
him
with him
playing
before she ever sees him.
Exactly.
You could argue.
Exactly. And later on, when she's spying on him, she looks in the transom window, but she doesn't really get a view. She just sits there and listens to him playing once again. And that piano scene, it does work problematically in the way she's positioned, in that she is like his puppy dog, as you said. But another way of looking at that is that you notice her eyes are watching his fingers play. So she's not looking up at his face. So I did like that continuing theme of the music also being one of these. It removed him less from being this specific figure than to this romantic ideal she was pursuing.
I think you're
And I think that works better overall for the film.
Yeah, I agree completely. I do want to talk about that train sequence, because I actually watched this movie with a friend of mine who is a film professor, hadn't seen in a while, and he at the beginning of the film said, oh, there's a famous sequence in this movie. There's one a lot of people write and talk about. He didn't tell me what it was. And then he actually, he's already seen it. He fell asleep watching the movie and I'm watching it. And then he woke up during this train sequence and he goes, this is the one. And I'm like, yeah, I got it.
It was
like,
so good. It woke him up.
Yeah, I think it did. But you knew it right away that, oh, this must be the sequence, because what it is the night of their first date. This movie has been building up to them finally getting together. And they have a pretty amazing night together. And one of the key parts in it is they go to some kind of almost amusement park ride, is what it seems like, where they sit in a train. It looks like they're on a real train, but the background behind them is the only thing that moves. A guy is pedaling a bicycle, and the background changes. So you can pretend that you are traveling through the Alps, or you're traveling through Germany, or wherever you want to go, just because they change the background and the guy pedals. And for the most part, other than some cutting, the camera really doesn't move. It just stays on this two-shot where we get to take in the background, take in their conversation as they get to know each other better. And what's so amazing about it is how it does rely on illusion, right? It's the sequence that relies on you in that moment to convince yourself that you're taking a train ride through Switzerland, as they do, because just the background changes, even though obviously they're not. They don't really believe it, but in that moment, they get swept up in the romance of it. And you think about how that relates to her character. She lives throughout this entire movie in this world of illusion. She tells her suitor at one point that she's engaged to be married because she really believes unreservedly that Stefan at some point is going to fall in love with her and they are going to be together. And in that sequence, I think she's convincing herself that he is really falling in love with her as they travel through Switzerland, because she wants to believe it, because she convinces herself of it. And I think that does sum up her entire state of mind, that train ride with the camera still and just the background moving. And of course, that sequence also gives us a bit of knowledge that proves absolutely pivotal later in the film. So it kind of makes sense that he stops the camera and makes us really focus on that sequence, because that dialogue, there's one line that's really going to come into play. And everything about Stefan, too, is really illusory, I think. If you think about what he says, this is where I thought the movie rose above the average melodrama with some of the dialogue. And we have to give credit to the screenwriter, Howard Koch, who also wrote Casablanca. So, you know, he's one of the writers. He knows what he's doing here. But he talks about how he laments his talent, that it does seem to be something he can't wrap his head around. He doesn't really know where it came from. He doesn't know if he'll ever keep it. He thinks maybe the accolades came to him too quickly, which also means they could go away very quickly. His fame, his recognition, it's not tangible, just as everything in their lives really is not tangible and an illusion. So that sequence is so beautiful and does sum up the whole film in many ways.
Tell me more about your father.
Well, then he finally did go away. He had the nicest eyes.
Yes, I can see them.
Why do you like to climb mountains?
Well, I suppose because no matter how high you climb, there's always a higher one.
And you like to imagine that the other one's even more wonderful, like spring in the park.
Now, you know far too much about me already, and I know almost nothing about you, huh? Except that you traveled a great deal.
End of the line. All change.
You know what's so charming about it, too, is the fact that we do see how the illusion is working. We see the guy pedaling the bike.
You do.
It goes back to what I was talking about, Oz. I mean, that's what we want, is to feel the magic, even if we see it at work. And this movie has some of that.
Indeed it does. That's the first film in our Max Ophuls Marathon, Letter from an Unknown Woman. And we were talking about how this is a movie that there weren't many ways to see it. It's hard to get unless you can find it from your local library, as we actually did. But Sam, our producer, found a link online, and you can watch the whole movie online.
Did he really?
Yeah, he did. And we will post that link in our show notes at filmspotting.net if you want to see it. Next week, we are going to discuss the second film in our Ophuls Marathon. It is La Ronde.
Aruba, Jamaica, Bermuda, Bahama? I don't think any of those will be on our list of the movie locations we'd like to visit.
Key Largo?
Perhaps that one. The Film Spotting Top 5 is next. Stay with us.
Somewhere over the rainbow,
Someday I'll wish upon a star and wake up where the clouds are far behind me.
We want to jump in here, folks, as we get to our donations and our thank yous this week to our listeners who were so very generous as to donate some of their hard-earned money our way in support of the show. We have four listeners we want to spotlight this week. But first, we did want to mention the music we're featuring on the show. If you hadn't figured out already, we are playing Somewhere Over the Rainbow, different variations than the one you hear from Judy Garland in the 1939 classic The Wizard of Oz, music by Harold Arlen and lyrics by E.Y. Yip Harburg. It did win the 1939 Academy Award for Best Song. As well, it should have. You heard Sarah Vaughan and also Willie Nelson with their renditions. Wanted to also quickly plug the Film Spotting Forum. We do this from time to time on the show, but there's a great community over there. It's available over at filmspotting.net. There's a link right at the top of the page that says Forum. We encourage you to go there and dive into the conversation. And they actually just finished up something they do annually here, have done for several years, the Film Spots. It's basically the Film Spotting Forum's Oscars, and we'll link to their results in our show notes, but we do encourage you to just go find it as well in the forum. And I'll say, Josh, they did really well. They did really well with their Film Spots, better than the actual Academy. Catherine Bigelow doesn't get overlooked. Joaquin Phoenix doesn't get overlooked. Johnny Greenwood doesn't get overlooked. So our listeners know what they're talking about. And we do encourage you to seek out their discussions. They also have a communal monthly film watch club that's just starting. So a lot of members are excited about this. They're going to have, from what it sounds like, a virtual community watching these movies and discussing them in the forum. So again, if you want to learn more, go to filmspotting.net and click on forum. Candace, our associate producer, who really is kind of the mother hen of the forum. She also notes that there's always a chance as well to talk with us when we stop by.
That's a plus?
I don't know if that's a plus. We don't stop by as often as we should. If you do want to interact with me, and I don't know why you would, all you got to do is say something negative about the show.
Yeah.
I will respond to that. I'll respond usually in about 30 seconds.
That is quite so true. You're going to get a lot of negative comments now.
Can't wait. Can't wait. I don't know why I just did that. Let's get to our donations. We thank a new $5 a month donor.
That would be Benjamin from Berkeley, California.
We also have a new Silver Club donation. That's Matt in New York, New York.
Thank you for the many hours of engaging conversation. If only there were more shows where intelligent conversation took place without heaps of irony, pop culture detritus, or overbearing personalities. If you two were talking about spark plugs or vegetable gardens, I would probably still tune in. That you are discussing movies, however, makes it all the better.
Wow. Thank you very much, Matt. We appreciate the kind words.
You know, we're about to embark on year two of the Larson Family Vegetable Garden. I could bring that up more often.
I love it. I mean, you're a true Renaissance man. We could devote an entire segment when the Ophuls Marathon ends, yes, perhaps, Josh.
There's great demand for that, I'm sure.
Wow. We also have a new donor, Jeff, in Rio Verde, Arizona. Sounds beautiful. And finally, William in Suffolk, UK.
Following a frisson of excitement last week after my poll question correction was read out, I realized as a longtime listener it was time to pay the dealer. Perhaps this could become a new paradigm for encouraging show donations. Cash for corrections.
That's dangerous.
It certainly motivates the pedant in me, irrespective of the cost to the show in plummeting intern retention rates. Keep up the good work.
Wow, cash for corrections. We could make a lot of money.
Oh, yeah.
And it's not a bad idea.
Even before we start making mistakes on purpose.
Exactly. Thank you, William, Jeff, Matt, and Benjamin. We really appreciate every penny we get. Another way you can support the show, and really, I can honestly tell you because I use this service myself and love it, that another way you can help is by signing up for MoviePass, or at least going to moviepass.com/filmspotting and checking out what they offer. This is the service that allows you to see unlimited movies in theaters nationwide for a flat monthly subscription rate. All you have to do is go to that link, moviepass.com/filmspotting, and use the offer code filmspotting. You get $10 off your first month of subscription.
I actually used it for Oz the Great and Powerful. It was slick. No problem at all.
Yeah, if you have an app, you have a card that comes with it, and it does work very easily. So again, that's moviepass.com/filmspotting. And we thank everyone who supports the show, however they do it, whether it's financially or patronizing one of our sponsors, or if you just help spread the gospel of Film Spotting, we really do appreciate it. Another partner who helps spread the word about Film Spotting is Jeff Goldsmith and his podcast, The Q&A with Jeff Goldsmith. He's going to be focusing this week on the incredible Burt Wonderstone with co-writers Jonathan M. Goldstein and John Francis Daly, who, I didn't know this, is the actor turned writer who played Sam Weir on TV's Freaks and Geeks. You can also check out Jeff's iPad app, which is called Backstory.
Yeah, Backstory issue 04 launched recently. Each of these issues has has filmmaker interviews, full-length scripts, short films, all sorts of stuff. For those fans of Argo, Backstory ran the first 20 pages of the screenplay Lord of Light. That's the real-life script that the CIA stole and retitled Argo. That's the one they used to fool the Iranian government. So just type Backstory into the iPad App Store if you want to download the first issue for free. That's for a limited time. And then keep an eye out for a web version. That should be coming later this year at backstory.net.
Where troubles smell like lemon drops, way above the chimney tops, that's where you'll find me somewhere over the rainbow.
Hi, this is John C. Reilly, and you're listening to Film Spotting.
How fast are they?
Well, we clocked the T-Rex at 32 miles an hour.
T-Rex?
Mm-hmm.
You said you've got a T-Rex?
Uh-huh.
Say again.
We have a T-Rex.
Put your head between your knees.
Dr. Grant, my dear Dr. Sattler, welcome to Jurassic Park.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. That's Sam Neill, Laura Dern, and the great Richard Attenborough from Steven Spielberg's Jurassic Park, which seemed appropriate to set up this week's top five movie locations we wish we could visit.
But not die in.
Exactly right.
So
and that might be one reason why Jurassic Park is actually an honorable mention for me, only because you do think if you went there, things very well could go badly. But in that scene, that sequence right there that we played is the one that I most remember from that film. I remember being just so caught off guard and amazed at the CGI there and thinking what it would be like. I was a dinosaur guy when I was a kid, like probably most young boys were, so I had that boyish rush when I saw those dinos on the screen, and it'd be a fun place to visit, but you're right, not die in. And that may come up a few times as we go through our lists, actually. I think for me, as we set up these lists, the key word really there is wish. We wish we could visit because we are not beholden to reality here. It is not about picking actual movie locations or actual sets. It's about fantasy places that only exist in cinema that we'd love to go to.
Yeah, fantasy is the key. My list leaned very heavily that way. Otherwise, I didn't put a lot of stress into putting this together. It felt like another one of these personal ones where these are places that just hit you
without
to the core when you first saw them and you want to go there and you remember them.
Yeah, I agree. I think I would just add, for me, it couldn't be just a cool place that you'd want to go see for the sake of seeing it. For example, the firehouse in Ghostbusters. Very memorable, but
that's for like a studio tour.
Yeah, but it's not something I'd be dying to go visit, or even Nakatomi Plaza in Die Hard. Very memorable location. It'd be fun to go there, just as you said, on maybe a studio tour. But these are places you truly would want to spend some time in on their own, completely separate from the connection to the movie. So you're right. The key is that fantasy aspect. It's a place that only the movies or art could transport you to. So with that all said, what's your number five?
Well, some people on Twitter and Facebook suggested Brazil. Some suggested Dark City, but I went with the 1927 silent film that inspired both of those, Fritz Lang's Metropolis. Now, this goes back to Jurassic Park a little bit.
It's an impressive world,
Josh. It's oppressive. It's a dark place. It's not the safest of places either. In fact, I think it was about a year ago that it made my list of the top five movie dystopias. So may seem like a little bit of an odd pick.
My number five, Soylent Green.
Let me explain. I wouldn't necessarily want to visit those massive underground factories where the laborers toil with the huge gears and levers. I don't want to go there. And I'm definitely not interested in the airy gardens of the aristocrats. Class. I mean, that just looked kind of boring, to be honest with you. But how about the towering city itself, that middle ground where a lot of the action takes place with the multi-level expressways that weave among all those buildings? You even have the dilapidated cottage of the mad inventor Rotwang. Very cool to check that out, squished between those two tall modern buildings. So Metropolis for me just remains, even though it's from 27, still one of the screen's most unique visions of a place, so why wouldn't you want to visit it?
I agree. It's one that does
you'll take
prove
the chance, you'll go with me.
Problematic, but it's such a remarkable world that is created on screen, especially when you consider it being 1927. And I think when it came up during our silent films marathon ages ago, I think it was like 2006 maybe, that was one of the things I really responded to, was how much you can see the influence of Metropolis in every single science fiction film that's followed, and you mentioned a couple of big ones there. Well, I'm going to stick with the dangerous theme here, but still being so astounded by it that I'd be drawn to it. And it's a place that comes from a film of the same name that's definitely going to come up whenever we get around to anointing the next batch of nominees to be potentially put into the film spotting pantheon. It is Solaris, the planet Solaris, from the Tarkovsky film from 1972, but I do also love the 2002 version directed by Steven Soderbergh. It definitely has made a fair number of lists over the years, but not for a good 6 months or so, Josh, so I feel comfortable bringing up Solaris. The only reason it's at number five, and why I almost left it off my list completely, is that there is a big downside. You will probably lose your mind if you visit the planet and never leave, or lose your mind, never leave, and end up killing yourself as one of the scientists does.
It's kind of what I was thinking.
Yeah, it's not maybe a happy place, but I will pose to you, how could you resist the opportunity to visit a planet that allows you to interact with loved ones you've lost in a way that absolutely feels real? And there'd be almost a challenge to it in, could you stay detached and could you study it and observe? Would you want to stay detached, or would you actually choose to live in that fantasy realm, even if it goes against all your rational thoughts? Even knowing what I was in for, I might just sign up for that mission, I have to be honest.
You're going to be the first man to Mars, aren't you, Adam?
That's it.
I like it. Number four, I'm going to offer as defense for all those misguided poll voters who selected Sam Raimi over Tim Burton. I got to go back a ways. Andy was only producer, but it was his idea. Halloween Town, The Nightmare Before Christmas. Henry Selick actually directed the stop motion feature, and it turned on Burton's ingenious idea that each holiday has its own town. Now, let's be honest, who's interested in Christmas Town? I mean, those Christmas year-round stores, I can't stand those places. So I don't want to go to Christmas Town. Much prefer the endlessly ghoulish town of Halloween. Boys and girls of every age, would you like to see something strange? This is a place that doesn't just have jack-o'-lanterns, it's a field full of jack-o'-lanterns, and when they open their glowing mouths, out come these misty ghosts. Among my favorite detail touches, and stop motion is all about the details, is how that precipice that Jack Skellington stands upon when he's silhouetted against the moon, it's really the iconic image from the movie. I love how the precipice uncurls before his feet as he walks, so he has somewhere else to go. I'm not goth, Adam. That's not in my background. You were a dino boy, I believe you said.
Your red pants certainly aren't goth, Josh.
No. But hey, I love this film.
Okay. Fair enough. A great pick there, The Nightmare Before Christmas. For my number four, I'm going to stick with this blurred line between reality and fantasy theme, which I didn't plan. It just came up as I went through my picks, and it's the example of coincidence spotting I was referring to earlier in the show as we talk about Letter from an Unknown Woman and that sense of illusion and fantasy that those characters have largely created for themselves. And my place is Caden Cotard's Warehouse from Synecdoche, New York, the Charlie Kaufman film. And if you've seen it, you know that Philip Seymour Hoffman plays Caden Cotard. He is a dramatist. He's a playwright. And even though he's struggling severely in every aspect of his life, especially personally, he somehow gets a MacArthur Fellowship grant and decides with it to rent out this warehouse, this huge open space, and basically recreate New York and recreate his life within that space. And throughout the course of the film, the warehouse just continues to expand, and the people in it and the places within it. And he also starts to bring in doppelgangers, people replicating not only the lives of normal people, quote unquote, but his own life and other people associated with this play, if you can call it that, he's putting on. So I think about this great scene with Philip Seymour Hoffman and Emily Watson as Caden and Hazel, and Tom Noonan and Samantha Morton as their doppelgangers. And you've got Caden not approving of how cutesy the imitation versions of them are getting with each other. I love those kind of touches, again, where that line really blurs in interesting ways. But for me, being inside that warehouse, not a place I'd want to stay for too long, but I would love to be in it. I'd love to observe a world like that for as long as I could before getting completely consumed by it, maybe setting up my own shop somewhere within it, which probably would happen.
I can totally see you there.
Yeah, I'd love it.
I think you'd be quite comfortable.
Yeah.
Well, obviously, fantasy, as we talked about, dominated this list for both of us. That's where my mind instantaneously went. But I did want to think about, just to play the game, were there any more realistic film creations that would be great locations to go to. And I did come up with one. I'm going to call it my Cheers pick, because when I was a kid, I always wanted to hang out at the bar in Cheers, even though it was complete fiction. Of course, this is before I grew up and realized they were probably all mostly functioning alcoholics and maybe wasn't the best
spot. Got aspire to something, Josh.
I guess. So my spot like this is the press room at the courthouse in His Girl Friday. This is the 1940 screwball comedy in which Cary Grant's newspaper editor convinces his ex-wife and former Star reporter, played by Rosalind Russell, to cover one last story. It's the execution of a convicted murderer. A lot of the central action in the film takes place in this press room at the courthouse, where the reporters, they gather there, they commiserate, they gossip. Sometimes they'll do a little bit of work.
They'll say that anybody that can write like that ain't going to give it up permanently to sew socks for a guy in the insurance business. Now I give that marriage 3 months, and I'm laying 3-1. Any takers?
I'll take that bet. Hey, it's getting so a girl can't leave the room without being discussed by a bunch of old ladies. Hello, Post? Hey, get me Walter Burns, will you, please?
Oh, don't get sore, Hildy. We were only saying a swell reporter like you wouldn't quit so easy.
This is Hildy Johnson. Oh, I can quit all right without a single quiver. I'm going to live like a human being, not like you chumps.
Now, I never worked in a newsroom that was really like this, even though I've been at a couple newspapers. I don't know if they ever really existed, to this degree at least. But my first newspaper job at a local weekly paper sort of aspired to that sort of camaraderie. And whenever I watch His Girl Friday, it at least always gives me fond memories of that job.
Yeah, I can see that. Of course, I love His Girl Friday, but don't you know that you're not allowed to actually bring that up because you're not Michael Phillips?
Yeah, I
know. His Girl Friday is his go-to film.
He had it on a recent list. Yes, it's true.
He's had it on like 3 recent lists, actually, but you really can't blame him. It's one of the all-time great screwball comedies, if not the greatest. There is a very funny SNL skit. I don't remember who the host was or when it was from, maybe 5 or 6 years ago. I wonder if other listeners out there remember this one, where it's a newsroom set. And it's either the case where the new young reporter thinks she's like Hildy, who talks in the screwball kind of way, but everybody else is like,
normal.
What is she talking about? Or it's the other way around, and they're all like that, and she's not. I can't remember, but it's actually very funny if you're a fan of a movie like His Girl Friday. You're listening to Film Spotting. We're sharing the top 5 movie locations we wish we could visit, inspired by our return to Oz in Sam Raimi's film Oz the Great and Powerful. And yes, the reality versus fantasy theme will continue with my number 3, but in a really direct way they're going to collide here, because unlike my last 2 choices, Solaris or Caden's Warehouse, this is a place that you can actually go and visit, and I have. But the real version just doesn't measure up to the screen fantasy. It's not heaven, Josh. It's Iowa.
Iowa? Yeah. Goodness, what it was heaven.
The Field of Dreams, which, as I said, I've been to. It's in Dyersville, Iowa. You can go actually be out on the field. You can see the house there. But I want to go to the Field of Dreams with the players. I want to get out on the field with the 1919 Chicago White Sox and other baseball legends. And yes, maybe get a chance to play catch with your dad again. That sounds pretty amazing. And that end scene when Costner gets that little frog in his throat at exactly the right moment when he asks his dad to have a catch.
Hey, Dad? You want to have a catch? I'd like that.
It gets me every time, even though I've never heard anyone actually use the phrase, have a catch.
No, I
certainly never
either.
Called it that myself. But that scene, the other one that gets me every time in Field of Dreams, Josh, is the scene in the van with James Earl Jones and Kevin Costner, and they pick up the hitchhiker along the road, the young kid, and he says he's looking for a place to play ball. And they tell him they're going to just such a place, and they ask him his name, and he says it's Archie Graham. And we realize it's the younger version of Moonlight Graham, Burt Lancaster, from where they just came. And that music twinkles a little bit, and James Earl Jones and Costner just look at each other completely dumbfounded. It chokes me up every single time. So I like baseball. It was the only sport I ever played. And being out on that field, actually getting to interact, obviously, in a fantasy world like that with those legendary players, that'd be pretty remarkable.
Only one question before I go see the real Field of Dreams. Is there a pizza ranch nearby?
I know you are a huge fan of the pizza ranch. I'm guessing there's one within about 3 blocks.
I like it. All right, number 2 for me, The Belafonte in The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou.
Wow.
This is one of Wes Anderson's more maligned pictures, with Bill Murray as a misguided explorer, but I really like it. What can I say? The Belafonte is Zissou's research vessel, and the movie boasts one of Anderson's, I think this is why it is maligned, people don't like it, some people don't like it when he does this to such a degree.
I'm raising my hand, yes.
It's one of his most exactly imagined dollhouse diorama sets. It's this astonishing sequence we get of a cross-section, a giant cross-section of the ship, and we move from room to room to see what's going on, and there's action going on in each room all at the same time. Just love that. This, too, is not exactly a happy place. It has that same sense of melancholy that pervades all of Anderson's films. Definitely it's pervasive here, but I still wanted to be part of the expedition on this ship. I think maybe because, like Anderson, I was infatuated with ocean explorer Jacques Cousteau as a kid. Huh. Loved the
Did
Jacques
you really?
Cousteau. Yeah, you never saw those, huh?
And drinking beer at Cheers. You were some kid.
Perfect night was when Jacques Cousteau's ocean show was followed by Cheers. That was awesome.
Yeah.
I don't think that was NBC's lineup, though. One of the more ingenious items I ever got from a PR department, as you know, they send these out for movies all the time, were Team Zisu trademark Speedos.
Nice.
That's what they sent.
Next live event.
Can't say they ever got a lot of use. Definitely don't have them anymore. But they did make me laugh.
Oh, come on. We could make some money promising that, I think,
Long
Josh.
Gone, Adam. Long gone.
That's too bad. So this is the part of the show where I should chide you for the fact that you picked a boat, which is a vessel, which is a thing, and not a place, right?
Go ahead if you want to. I wasn't really doing any sort of grammar lesson while
no,
I was making this list.
You know what? For me, it doesn't really count as a location, but here's where I'll give you the pass. There's no doubt, especially within the construct of that film, that that ship is their home. That is a community. It's what you always talk about when you bring up Wes Anderson. So I'll let it slide.
Do you see the relief on my face?
Yeah, I know. You couldn't wait to have me exonerate you for that pick. So where do you actually rate The Life Aquatic in your ranking of Wes Anderson films?
I rate it above Darjeeling Limited.
Okay.
And trying to think if there's anything else. Possibly above Bottle Rocket.
So it's third from the bottom? Is that what you're saying?
It's in the middle.
It's in the middle.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
It was, for me, as I ranked it recently on Letterboxd.
His worst.
Just below Darjeeling Limited as my least favorite Wes Anderson film.
It is for
and
a lot of people.
I get a lot of grief for it. It's a film I only did see once and maybe should give another chance to. A movie that I do not need to give another chance to, because I actually rewatched it fairly recently. We talked about, I think, in some bonus content, and it's a movie I saw 100 times as a kid. My place comes from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory. It is Willy Wonka's Chocolate Factory. Hold your breath. Make a wish. Count to three.
Come with me, and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look, and you'll see into your imagination.
I don't know if you've discovered this about me or not, Josh. I hide him under the booth here. I hide him under the console so you don't see it. I've got a bit of a sweet tooth.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So, you know, I've got chocolate stashed here in the room. I'm a fan of candy, particularly chocolate candy. And I'm not going to lie. If I walked into that room and saw that chocolate river, I'm going Augustus
Don't do it,
all
Adam.
Up in
Don't
there.
Do it.
I am diving right in that chocolate river. I don't care what happens to me. They can whisk me away. They can kick me out. I would just have to have that experience of diving in that chocolate river. But seriously, every room in that chocolate factory is incredible. There's something new and different and exciting wherever you go. In the case of that famous boat and that sequence that everyone remembers from Willy Wonka, especially if you were a kid and you were a little bit freaked out by it, something new and exciting and, yes, terrifying. But I think about that scene, how good, not only throughout that whole film, but especially in that scene, when that's the first room they really go into, how good is Gene Wilder as Willy Wonka? The song he sings, it's sort of bittersweet, it's melancholy, he's lamenting growing up, really, and nobody having time anymore to get lost in a place of imagination like that. And even if you are still young enough, if you're these kids, most of them, as he knows going into it, are kids who are going to come in and just be really greedy and take whatever they want because they think they deserve it. But for me, all the chocolate you could ever want in one place, that's paradise.
See, I love that movie despite the fact that I don't really like chocolate. I don't do desserts. Somehow it still works
and
for me.
I knew there was something wrong with you. That's the thing that's most wrong with you, Josh.
This is at the root of all our disagreements,
I think.
My number one, the title names the location, Where the Wild Things Are. Spike Jonze's 2009 adaptation of the classic Maurice Sendak picture book was the best picture of that year, partly because of the unique world that was created. It was one that was true to Sendak's vision, which was very unique, but it was also something even wilder and weirder in a lot of ways. If you had such an impoverished childhood that no one read this picture book to you, it's about an unruly boy named Max who gets sent to his room for misbehavior.
I'm also raising my hand.
You didn't watch Jacques Cousteau or read Where the Wild Things Are?
Probably did see an episode of Jacques Cousteau, but no one ever read me. Alas, poor boy that I am.
After we're done recording, I'll read it to you.
I love it.
Well, Max imagines that he's transported to a land of dangerous and bizarre creatures who make him king. Now, Jones and his collaborators, they bring this to life with all sorts of elaborate creative elements. They use natural landscapes. They also use these giant puppets. There is some computer imagery going on here, but it's very subtle. And, of course, there's great voice work going on.
I have an idea. Come out!
No!
Why not?
Because you're going to hit us in the head with dirt.
Come out!
No!
Why not?
Because when I said you're going to hit us in the head with dirt, you didn't say anything! That means you're planning to hit us in the head with dirt!
Man... you really have us figured out.
So this place is basically the best playground ever. They spend a lot of time building forts, rampaging through forests, but there's also a sense of danger. It's similar to Willy Wonka, as you pointed out. The surroundings here are dangerous because the wild things themselves, partly, not just because it's this scary forest. I mean, these things could turn on Max at any minute. I think that's what I most liked about this movie is that it did recognize and devoted itself to the feral nature of kids, the side of them that we parents kind of whisper about in concern to each other at night after they're in bed
right. And
they've been really bad. And we realize we're raising wild things
I've got one of those. I do have one of those.
I believe it. This is really, it's just a great, quickly forgotten film. I love Where the Wild Things Are.
I am a big fan of that film as well. But that choice coming off of Willy Wonka marks another difference between us, Josh, which is you're a little bit more of an outdoorsy guy than I am. I'd prefer the chocolate factory where there's probably air conditioning.
There probably is.
I really don't need to be out in the
wild.
They
gotta keep that chocolate river cool.
Exactly. I don't want animals rampaging around me. They're smelly. I need a hotel or somewhere that has a nice bed I can stay in.
I think you're onto something there.
And I think I would find that type of luxurious life in my number one pick for the movie location I most wish I could visit. Cue up the George Gershwin. Like the Field of Dreams, this is a place that really exists. It's Manhattan. It's New York City. But it doesn't quite exist the way it looks through the eyes of Woody Allen and his DP Gordon Willis in his 1979 gorgeous black and white film, of course, called Manhattan.
Chapter 1. He adored New York City, although to him it was a metaphor for the decay of contemporary culture. How hard it was to exist in a society desensitized by drugs, loud music, television, crime, garbage. Too angry. I don't want to be angry. Chapter 1. He was as tough and romantic as the city he loved. Behind his black-rimmed glasses was the coiled sexual power of a jungle cat. Oh, I love this. New York was his town, and it always would be.
As we hear his narrator at the beginning of the film, this is a place he romanticizes all out of proportion. And that is exactly what Woody Allen does throughout the movie Manhattan. It seems to be the most sophisticated, most beautiful, buzzing place in the entire world. And this actually just came up the other day, Josh, with a friend of mine. I was talking to him, and he remarked that he had never been to New York City before and really wanted to go. And I've only been there maybe 3 or 4 times, maybe 5 times. But I can remember each time, but especially that first time, having that feeling as you walk down the street, unlike any other place I've been. And I've been to some other countries. I've been to Paris and Rome and some other major cities, London, Dublin. Walking in New York City and feeling like you're always in a movie set. You've seen it so many times on screen, not just in Woody Allen films, but on TV throughout the history of cinema, that you have a weird relationship with it if you're not from there. And I do think we romanticize it, probably all out of proportion to what life there is really like. And speaking of that, there is that downside with Woody Allen's Manhattan. As people have critiqued him over the years, it's going to be predominantly rich, and it's definitely going to be predominantly white. I think you have to acknowledge that, but I still really wish I could walk around all night with Isaac, with Mary, with Woody Allen and Diane Keaton in that film, just talking until the sun comes up and ending up under that Queensboro Bridge, the 59th Street Bridge, sitting on that park bench talking as the sun comes up. That, for me, is the location I most want to visit.
I like that we both had black and white films on our list. I think that speaks to kind of the enduring appeal of that cinematography to create a sense of place. I think it also speaks to one of the very good things about Oz the Great and Powerful, those first 20 minutes.
You had to recall that. You had to go back. I was hoping you wouldn't, but you had to go back to Oz the Great and Powerful. What about some honorable mentions? What were other locations that were tough to leave off?
wanted to put Waterworld on this list. There are many, many, many things wrong with this picture, but one thing they get really right is this vision of a flooded planet. I do have sort of a soft spot for Waterworld. Endor, you know, Return of the Jedi, it's my only opportunity to get an original trilogy film on a top five because Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back are in the pantheon, but I don't think Endor quite makes it for me. Even as a kid, I wasn't quite sold on the Ewoks.
Yeah, I can see that.
Neverland, of course, the Disney version. And lastly, Princess Mononoke's Medieval Japan. I think that's what it is in that film.
I could see a lot of Miyazaki being good picks for this list. I also considered the L.A. that we see in Blade Runner. Seems like a pretty fascinating world. We'll stick with Charlie Kaufman and go with John Malkovich's head. I'd like to be inside John Malkovich's
head.
Really?
Would you really?
Yeah, I would. Come on, to see what it's actually like to be somebody. You saw the movie. They get pretty obsessed with it.
Yeah,
it must be intoxicating to be inside John Malkovich's head. Another one that I have mixed feelings about but would be in awe of, certainly, is The Fortress of Solitude from Superman. Now, it'd be kind of cold.
Boring.
It'd be kind of cold, and since I'm not Superman, I can't really activate any of the cool stuff.
Yeah, you're
but
just
come
looking
on.
At a bunch of
How
snow
many
and
times
ice.
As a kid, though? I'll go back to Where the Wild Things Are. How many times as a kid did you get out there and pack snow and make a fort and just play in a fort? This is the fort that ends all forts.
No, I was inside reading Where the Wild Things Are.
Of course you were. Finally, wouldn't it be fun to be a little bit hedonistic, at least through the 70s, not so much the 80s, in Jack Horner's mansion from Boogie Nights?
Oh, yuck.
I'd like to spend a weekend in Jack Horner's mansion.
I think we better stop this now. By the way, given your preference for AC, I guess we should call off the Larson Kempinar family camping trip.
It's done.
Boy.
Forget it. Forget it. Unless you've got air conditioning somewhere in your Larson tent.
I'll work on that.
It's not happening. Those are our top five movie locations we wish we could visit. Send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voice. Mail 206-203-2463 or find us on Twitter at FilmSpotting and at Facebook.com/FilmSpotting.
Out in wide release this weekend, The Call. This is Halle Berry and Abigail Breslin in a Brad Anderson movie that really does have a completely preposterous setup. She's a 911 operator who receives a call from a girl who's just been abducted, realizes she must confront a killer from her past in order to save the girl's life.
I don't know, Adam. Sounds like a lot of stakes to me.
High stakes. You're right. It could be great cinema. Also, the incredible Burt Wonderstone. This is Steve Carell and Jim Carrey as rival magicians because apparently there can only be one famous magician in the world.
Now, Debbie wants to go see this one. I'm kind of intrigued. I put an email out there towards you and I got radio silence.
You
so
did.
I'm assuming not going to happen.
Probably not going to happen, though. I'm not going to lie. I'm a little bit curious about it. I like Steve Carell a lot, so who knows? But speaking of actors I do like a lot, there's James McAvoy as London Detective Max Lewinsky in Welcome to the Punch. He apparently has one last chance to catch his nemesis, ex-criminal Jacob Sternwood, played by my guy. I mentioned him during Oz, Mark Strong. And you do have to love the names, Lewinsky and Sternwood. They do sound like CPAs, but, you know, we'll go with it.
Those are good names.
Limited release here, opening in Chicago, Koch. This is the documentary about the late New York City mayor. Reincarnated. This is another documentary about your favorite musician, Josh. I know, Snoop Doggy Dogg and his travels to Jamaica.
Favorite?
Yeah, why not? Well, now you like it more as he's got into his reggae phase as Snoop Lion.
Yeah, that's true.
And that's what the film chronicles, so you'll really appreciate that. And then we've got two movies here that the descriptions are just so perfect, we have to read them. K-11. After binging on drink and drugs, a record producer finds himself in a section of the L.A. County Jail reserved for homosexuals, ruled by a transsexual named Mousy. That's the description.
Stakes, Adam.
High stakes. Also high stakes, Upside Down. Kirsten Dunst and Jim Sturgis in a fantasy romance about a couple who meet and fall in love as teens, despite the fact that they live on twinned worlds with gravities that pull in opposite directions.
It's the gravities that's really going to make that one work.
I think it will really sell it. Also out, on a more serious note, Beyond the Hills. This is the latest from Romanian director Christian Mungiu, who made a great film, 4 months, 3 weeks, and 2 days. This is a movie about two young women who grew up in the same orphanage, and they end up reuniting, meeting each other again at a monastery. So that sets up our review of that film and our top five next week, our top five movie religious figures.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
safest bet.
The thing is, I think, too, no one's ever corrected us. I've never heard anyone say it this way, but I really wonder if it's not "au fools," because it's French, so they would emphasize the second, not "we Americans do the au fools."
Right.
That's not how they talk, though.
Right. I'm trying to think of how Michael said it.
I think he said it "au fools."
I think he did.
I do.